This is a man that needs no introduction.
Who is this guy?
The most knowledgeable columnist in the city of Pittsburgh.
Some in our audience don't know the finer points of hockey.
He goes by only one name.
Hotter than Bond, cooler than Bullet. Shaft.
No, it's not Shaft. It's Rossi. And he's here right now on Trip Live Radio.
Ah, yeah, crowded studio now. We're brought to you by the Team Spanos Group of Raymond James, Pittsburgh Magazine's Face of Financial Guidance. The face of Trip Total Media sports coverage, I dare say, is Rob Rossi. He's our Trip columnist. He's with us now. How are you, Rossi?
That's only because they haven't found a way to superimpose somebody else's face. So.
Like Colleen Dominguez.
Yeah.
Rossi, we've been taking Jagoff of the Year votes. This is a very important process. It's a two-day
Congratulations,
affair.
Tim.
No, not yet. Not yet.
That was a trip for bringing me back.
We have leading candidates. Want to get your thoughts on these guys. The puck-stealing dude at the Penguins game and the Dan Boswell
return.
Oh, yeah, I
forgot about him. Yeah.
Johnny Football, Roger Goodell, and those are the big three right now. I'm pushing for Joe Madden, but it's not getting much love. Do you have a sense of who the biggest jag-off in 2015 was, looking back on it?
That's a really good question. Of those candidates, I would just say Roger because it seems like everything he touches turns to poo, for lack of a better thing. Jagoff of the year. I got to be honest, my vote would go to somebody that if I said it, it would seem so nasty.
Grim Rutherford.
Just say Rutherford and get it
yeah.
over with.
I just think if we're going to look locally, I'm not sure anybody in one calendar year had a worse year than Jim Rutherford. So, in terms
Boy,
of
the
performance,
way Goodell screwed up that whole Deflategate thing.
No! I just meant
that's
local. I think Jagoff of the year should be Roger Goodell. I'm just saying I don't know that there was a Pittsburgh sports person that had a worse year.
Antoine
in terms
Blake
of performance. Yes, because every once in a while somebody didn't score a touchdown on Blake. I'm still trying to figure out what Rutherford did in 2015 that actually worked, other than firing the coach. Which the way they're playing right now, we might look back and wonder if that wasn't wrong because they might have done it too late. So.
Well, yeah, I want to get your thoughts here on the new year. I mean, at least from New Year's Eve on, this team has looked a little different, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. I think their big challenge is. Well, I think they got two big challenges. One is they have to establish what an identity is for them. I think they're maybe getting towards one, but I can see that being a struggle for Mike Sullivan and this particular Penguins team the rest of the year, only because I don't know, looking at their roster, what their identity can be consistently. It seems like if they get a certain type of opponent, the Blackhawks, the Red Wings, not an overtly physical team, an Islanders team that's not overtly physical, they're going to be able to skate a little bit. Now, the Penguins aren't a super fast team, but they are a skilled team, that those type of teams will be able to play a style that the Penguins can counter. I wonder what this is going to be like when they start playing the Washingtons of the world, who are very physical but also have skill. Is that going to be a style that the Penguins can have a lot of success against? I have my doubts, only because I still see teams successfully being able to get on top of the Penguins' defense. You see Chris Letang in these games, and you go, wow, where's that been? Well, that hasn't been there because when they play a physical team, he just doesn't have the opportunities to do what he's doing. But they are playing better. It's amazing how we overlook what Letang and Crosby meant from a standpoint of they've looked a lot better since those two have started looking more like themselves. What was missing for 3 months was essentially the Crosby and Letang that, you know, existed in the earth that we knew before the Penguins were the Mike Johnston, you know, Jim Rutherford product. So, yeah, they're playing better. They have to. I said it a couple weeks ago. January 15th is a big date for me because I thought they had to either be in the top eight or be one of the two teams that were closest to the top eight. If you are 12th or 13th or whatever on January 15th, you put yourself in a position where it's unlikely you're going to make it only because you have so many teams you're battling with. You see how hard it is now. It's just hard to make up ground because of the teams you're battling with. And you know, one of those teams is Tampa Bay was in the Cup Final last year, and you have to think they're probably going to do some things that will – make them better. I don't know what the Penguins can do trade-wise. I don't know. I just don't know because they don't have a lot of cap room and they don't have a lot of options.
What are your thoughts on 3-on-3 compared to what they were when they first announced they were going to do it?
I still hate it.
Do you?
Yeah. My concern with 3-on-3 was this. We're going to see some really cool things, but we're also going to see some teams, and I thought this was going to happen, and I'll be interested to see how it happens in the second half. I think once you get to these – look, what happens in January, right, guy, is that you start playing a lot of 3-on-3 hockey, right, because teams start playing a lot of three-point games. So a lot of these games go to overtime, right? And are teams going to be conservative in those? You know, are we going to see more two defensemen and a checking forward out there more than we see? Because because teams take the approach, we'd rather get to the shootout, you know? We'd rather take our chances there. If that doesn't happen, I'll be pleasantly surprised. But I don't like it. I think we'll see at the All-Star game that it's a little of it goes a very long way. But I just don't think it's hockey.
It is. It was entertaining to watch, but a perfect thing that supports your argument. Calgary is 9-1 in overtime. They're a 500 hockey team, yet nine of their wins have come in 3-on-3.
There's no difference.
They're 18-18.
In my opinion, between winning a tricked out 3-on-3 versus winning a tricked out shootout.
I agree.
No, I agree.
I agree. My concern, look, I never liked...
Because you're already having people do what he's doing right now, which is look at the numbers and say, well, this is a 3-on-3 team.
Or, to me...
Penguins were a shootout team. You know?
Right.
I know I'm in the minority. I actually think it was a better representation of who the best teams were than they had ties. But I understand that their view is American fans find ties confounding. Okay, fair enough. I've never understood why the NHL wants to go to a five-minute overtime that doesn't look like their regulation hockey, and then to a shootout. To me, just go to the shootout, make it five rounds, and after the third round, you can pick three shooters, right? But make it best of five. And after the third round, you can use whoever you want again. So if you want to have...
Like the Olympics?
Yes, if you want to have a TJ Oshie motion, just do it. Because what fans like is the skill. And I think the shootout is more exciting for the fans than 3-on-3, or will prove to be that, because it's still a better representation of the one-on-one skill. Because I don't think you can really play defense or offense in 3-on-3 hockey. It's just a matter of, is there a turnover in the right place where you can, you know, take advantage of it?
Well, your theory about playing two defensemen or a defensive forward in the 3-on-3 as the season wears on is interesting, because it's like, the league keeps coming up with a way to extend it one more exciting rung, and coaches keep coming up a way with keeping it conservative. I mean, people didn't like 2-2 ties, so they went to an overtime, and then nothing was happening in the overtime anyway. There'd be three total shots on goal, and teams didn't want to lose the point that they had already gained. So then they went to the shootout. And then almost every overtime, well, there was no goal, because teams would then settle it in the shootout and be glad to take the point.
The only way I see it changing is if – you eliminate the loser point.
Yeah.
You know?
Or make winning in regulation
or make
3.
Or winning regulation 3. Like, as long as you can play for, you know, if you're team A chasing, or team A and team B is chasing you, and you're playing each other, okay? If you're team A, what is the incentive to try to win that game in that situation? As opposed to losing the point.
Right.
You know? Now they get two as opposed to you get, you know,
it doesn't make sense that you get the same amount of points for winning in overtime as you do in winning in regulation, but you get a point for losing in overtime, but you get nothing for losing
especially
in regulation.
When
it can't all be the same.
Especially when they measure regulation wins as a tiebreaker. I don't understand why the tiebreaker isn't just built into the point system. I mean, I would always argue that the Jagoffs of the year should be the general managers of the NHL, because they keep coming up with these ways to confound people that watch the game. They come up with a system that allows literally everybody to be in contention.
That's a good thing, isn't it?
No,
that smart?
It's not, because what it does is it completely waters down the product. I think you've seen that in the NFL this year. I think you've seen a situation where it's very hard unless you really believe Carolina and Arizona are heads and shoulders above everybody. I mean, it's really hard to say one team is that much better than the other. I think because the NFL has just been building to that for 30 years, and I think hockey has done the same thing. The difference is in the playoffs in hockey, you can have a team like Chicago or L.A. sort of impose its will on you in a seven-game series. It's tougher to do that in a one-game playoff.
Rob Rossi, our guest here on Trib Live Radio. All our Steelers-Bengals playoff coverage this week brought to you by Goodrich & Geist. Pursuing justice for real people online at goodrichandgeist.com. And Rossi, I'd be remiss if not to stoke the fires here between our own resident Trump and Obama. You and Tim have been bashing heads the last couple weeks in regards to Tomlin's job security. You want to crow a little
just
bit after the win last week?
Just last week.
I feel like Tim and I are on the same page like 90% of the times. It's just when we disagree,
what?
It's like...
Last 2 weeks, but it's been different topics. I don't think it was Tomlin the week before or something else the week before. But remember, I did say that the job scrutiny should come under challenge if they lost to the Browns, which they didn't
do.
Because I think that would just be the cherry on the sundae of what has been a repeated pattern of him for losing to lesser teams.
And I probably did not make clear enough. I agree that the job performance should be under scrutiny. It was the, should they replace him? I didn't think they should replace him. But I wrote a column Sunday saying, look, there are some tough questions you have to ask if they don't make the playoffs. You know, I still think you have to ask those questions. You know, where is this defense ultimately going? You know, why can't they beat the Ravens? I think those are all still fair questions. You know, if they lose this week, we still have the same fundamental principle, right, Tim, that they haven't won a playoff game in five
years.
And this
years.
Would be as bad of a loss as any that they've had under Tomlin that isn't named Tebow, right? If you lose to A.J. McCarron.
Well, my biggest gripe, whether it was with our conversation last week or Ken brought it up again yesterday, even in regards to another coaching position, I can't remember which one, Ken, you brought up, but that was open now. Might have been the Giants, but... Because the list of coaching candidates doesn't make your eyes pop, you say to yourself, well, what are you going to do? Why hire somebody then aside from the guy that you currently have in place? That line of thinking, the Penguins never would have gotten Dan Bylsma. You know, that line of thinking, the Penguins never would have gotten Mike Tarrion.
Well,
that line of thinking, the Penguins would still have Mike Johnston.
Yes and no, because football is unique that there isn't a minor league. You don't have a guy in your system. I mean, when the Penguins promoted Mike Tarrion, he had been coaching in Wilkes-Barre. They had a look at him. The same thing with Dan Bylsma. I would same thing with Mike Sullivan. I would presume if the Steelers were ever in a situation where they were firing Mike Tomlin, that they wouldn't be promoting one of his assistants. So my argument solely has been the Steelers historically are not experienced in this. They don't have the experience of sort of saying, look, suddenly we're going to fire our coach. Now, that doesn't mean they shouldn't have that experience. It just means that, like, I don't know how they're going to react to that. It seems to me that they've been pretty methodical over the years when they've conducted coaching searches.
They just can't find a good candidate until you look. Like, they found Mike Tomlin.
Yeah.
They looked, and he was a good hire.
Yeah. They just didn't have – I'm just saying they hadn't fired him. When Chuck Knoll and Bill Cowher left – they had begun the process of anticipating, you know, this is a possibility. I would argue that I trust the Rooney.
Cowher probably might. Well, Cowher would have stayed if they'd have paid him more money. That seemed to be
maybe,
a fight.
Yeah.
More of a financial
consideration.
I'd be
interested to see if Cowher throws his ring into the hat for the Giants.
I think
ring
he's
into
done.
The hat?
Yeah. Ring into the hat. Did I say ring into the hat? Yeah. I'm throwing my ring into your hat.
You only won one ring.
Yeah.
You better hold on to it.
Yeah. I throw it into your hat, Giants.
I would also argue, though, that, you know, in both of those cases, the candidates that they eventually hired that worked out emerged later in the process.
Yeah.
For as much as they had started the process, it looked like it was going to be Dave
Wannstedt
first.
Ken's premise is you better know who you're going to hire if you're going to get rid of them when we were discussing it last
week.
Well,
I think you better have a list of people you want to interview.
Well, that may be, but in both times someone emerged that wasn't on their original list. So
to use the Penguins example, which I think I used during this conversation, they didn't have a list. They didn't have a narrowed down list of people when they fired Ray Shero, right?
Like they had a hit list. That's all they had.
But they openly talked about, we have 37 candidates. Who? Like me? Guy? Tim? Ken?
I mean, Pierre.
You know, like, you have 37.
I'll coach the goalies.
If you have 37 candidates for this job, then you have too many candidates. Like,
yeah.
You should have a list of, you know, I think if you're going to hire a coach, what is a fair number? 5 or 6 of guys that you really want to talk? Like, you should have identified that list. It's so weird because we live in a city where this just doesn't happen. When you see teams fire coaches, I'm always surprised at the people they end up talking to, because it's usually coordinator du jour, right? There's a group of coordinators. Then there's the group of former coaches that maybe we don't hear about as much. And then there's sort of these, like, wild card, college coaches, whatever. I mean, like, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, I don't really know how it works that well because we just don't see it enough. I mean, I think they've hired the right guys when they've made the hires. That doesn't mean they need to hold on to them for 15 years.
Why do you think it is? I was thinking about this yesterday. I mean, coaches, managers are hired to be fired. But in hockey, they go stale faster. Nobody lasts very long in the NHL. Even guys that win cups a couple of years later are looked at even with a very similar roster to the one they won a championship with, and suddenly they don't know what they're doing. It doesn't seem to happen. It seems to me in baseball and football, the demise is more personnel related.
I think hockey players quit on their coaches more than any other athletes sooner. Mm. I think a hockey player...
Well, you know what it is? It's the physical grind of 16 games extended over 82. Like, it's the get in your face and kick you in the ass. That gets so tiresome when you take a 16-game NFL schedule and apply it to an 82-game mentality.
Well, and where does coaching matter? Like, okay, probably in no sport does it matter more than football. Coaching. I'm not saying the head coach. Coaching, right? And then basketball at the NBA level has been in... individualistic sport. I mean, if you're the coach that has the best players, you often have success. I mean, Cleveland went to the NBA Finals.
You throw it in, you shoot.
Yeah, Cleveland went to the NBA Finals, and I don't think anybody even knows who their coach is. You know, it's David Blatt, but I mean, you know, that was LeBron James, right? Managers, baseball's such a weird dynamic because it's individual, right? It's an individual sport, and the manager can do some things, and we do, you know, we've been critical of Clint Hurdle, and certainly, but like, I mean, for as great as Tony La Russa was, what is the difference between Tony La Russa and Clint Hurdle? Over 162 games. Is it three games? Does he win three more games? Okay, so then you get to hockey. Well, the system does matter, but there's only so many systems in hockey. Like, everybody plays a left-wing walk or a version of the neutral zone trap. There isn't a new defensive system that's come out there. When Dan Bylsma came in here and opened things up, and people were like, oh, this is unbelievable, these stretch passes, and it's like, they're shooting the puck from an area in the offensive zone that is more advantageous than they were under Therrien because they're getting it through the zone with speed. This wasn't like he came up with a new theory. Like, it was like we moved the puck better, and so those guys got into the offensive zone with more speed, and they were able to generate quality shots, right? There isn't, you know, everybody's doing what Scotty Bowman still did in the 70s, basically defensively. I think hockey players get a free pass because the sport's primarily covered in Canada, where they just aren't that critical of them. And then you come down to the States, and a lot of people covering hockey don't know it. And, I mean, is there a greater example of the players quitting on the coach than what we've seen of this version of Sidney Crosby than the one under Mike Johnston? You can't look at what we've seen of Sidney Crosby since Mike Sullivan's become the head coach and go, wait a minute, where was that for the other guy?
Yeah, I can. I can look at what happened with Terry and Bylsma.
Okay, but my point
is... supports his point, I think.
No, I'm amplifying his point. I'm saying he did it before.
He's done it at the end of the Bylsma era, that Ranger series. You know, I'm not saying Sid's the only one. Mario Lemieux did this routinely. Jaromir Jagr did this routinely. In hockey, the franchise player is allowed to just say, screw it, I'm done with this guy, and I'm just going to stink out loud.
Look at Ovechkin with Barry Trotz.
Ovechkin got, you know, and they brought in a coach that they basically told Alex, like, look, we're sticking with this coach. That's why it happens. Hockey players quit, you know. I've seen, you've covered hockey teams that have quit on their coach going into the playoffs, you know. Remember that, you've covered it both
Jagr
ways.
Jagr
and Alinka. Do you remember? Yeah, Jagr just tanked that second half. He won the scoring title and then tanked the postseason. Do you remember the Jersey Devils, how many times they just quit on their coach? They quit on Robbie Fatorik, like, at the end of a season. They had the best record in the NHL. It's like, we're done with this guy. It's this myth that hockey players think only about the Stanley Cup. Because if they don't like their coach, they don't care if they have the best record in hockey going into the playoffs. When their hockey players are done with a coach, they're done with their coach. And they're going to do anything they can to get the coach fired, which is why general managers have to, like, if the Penguins don't make the playoffs, I think there's a good chance maybe others, will look back and go, Jim Rutherford should have fired Mike Johnston after the game in New Jersey, where Evgeny Malkin came out and said, all those things he said, I forget what they exact were. The Penguins' reaction was, let's make sure
we don't like each other.
Yeah. Let's make sure we massage the message. You know, yeah. That was the Penguins' response. When he was saying we don't like each other, I know Evgeny Malkin. He wasn't saying we, as in the room, don't like each other. He was saying we, as in the guys behind the bench, we don't like each other. Mm. We don't like them.
I think of all the major sports, the one the players need the coaches the most are football, though. Baseball is individual, and even if you don't like the manager, you don't want to go up and strike out on purpose. It's a reflection on you. You want to perform. I mean, broadcasting is a lot like that. You can be in management argument with management or upset with you didn't get the money you wanted in a contract or your vacation situation.
You can't go out and do a shit show.
You're not going to go on air and do a crappy show because people listen to you don't know what's going on. I mean, The old Joe DiMaggio line, some kid might be watching me for the first time today. I want to play. But in football, you cannot go out there and perform without a game plan. No, I don't care if you're the greatest quarterback in the league. You need help.
My biggest criticism of
you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, other people have to be told what to do.
Yeah.
So they don't
football
freelance.
Players need coaches more than any of the other sports we're talking
because
about.
Literally, it's 11 people working together at exactly the same time.
And if
time,
one guy's wrong, it's all wrong. You know, my biggest criticism of Mike Tomlin is actually broader, but also specific. I presumed when they hired him, based off everything I read and heard, that he would be one of these guys that when they got young players, he would, to use a cliche, coach them up. And I've not seen that. Like, I presumed that they would be able to draft or even bring in people for their secondary because he was a secondary coach and everything you read about him, and we would see these guys sort of playing above their grade, to use a Tomlinism. I've not seen enough of that. Now, I also don't have the football acumen to say maybe there are situations like that, but I haven't seen enough of that.
Well, I think their offensive line this year is a tribute to Munchak.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, I can look at the offensive line and go, okay, but like Mike Tomlin's a defensive coordinator. He was a defensive backs coach, right, in Tampa.
Yep. Yeah,
that was where he came in. Like, I didn't see enough of that. Now,
the biggest weakness on the team is the secondary.
That said, they have been better this year at creating turnovers and at, you know, causing some pressure. Is that Tomlin? Is that that's where I never know. Like, because I think there are two type of coaches in football. You guys have followed the NFL a lot more than me. To me, it seems like there's two. There's the Belichick coaches who they're involved in everything, and then there's the Tomlin type coaches who seem to be more of a CEO. The danger in that is when you start involving yourself in things after giving some authority to other guys. You know, like, is Todd Haley calling the plays on offense? Is Ben Roethlisberger audibling? Like, I never know. There was that play in, who did they play 2 weeks? Baltimore. The pick that was returned, right? That they raved off.
Yeah.
Somebody asked me, like, you know, why are they calling that play? And I'm like, I don't even know who's calling it. Is it Tomlin? Is it Haley? Is Ben just doing that? Like, and you never get a straight answer.
No.
So I don't know. Like, you know, I know the Penguin coaches for years have been telling Sidney Crosby, we want you near the net on the power play. And then when Sidney Crosby gets on the power play, he goes to the half wall. And then the whole power play changes. So to me, it's like, well, yeah, you got to bring in a coach who's going to tell him what to do. They've had every coach has told him what to do. He wasn't listening.
Well, so many offenses, and the Steelers are part of this, have turned into there is a game plan and it's empowered to the quarterback to get to the line of scrimmage. And you can call this play, or this play in that situation, depending on the look you get on defense.
Yeah.
So that's part of the reason why Ben always says, I called that play. Or what he means by that, he didn't call that play. That was his check. That was his look. That was his choice of three that he could go to. The menu. We always hear about the menu. So, you know, who's calling what plays? You know, they design the plays, they give them to Roethlisberger, and they say, based on what you have in this formation, when you get that look from the defense, you can call one of three or one of four or whatever.
So in the fourth and one on Baltimore,
I assume the decision to go for it is Tomlin's. The decision what to do is Haley's with a couple of options for Roethlisberger. I think that's the way it goes.
Well, sometimes, yeah, I mean, like, a lot of what I'm talking about is kind of second and 10 sort of talk. Because like you said, if it's a fourth and one, you can only do so much with the personnel that's in there. You know, if they say run the ball from fourth and one and here's the play, you know, I guess Roethlisberger could have checked out of that. But what can he check out of with two tight ends?
I think a lot of it, too, is with coaching. I think a lot of it is whether the thing worked or not. I mean, I watched this documentary, Tim. You covered that team last year, that Patriots team. There was this documentary.
The Do Your Job thing?
The Do Your Job thing. And do you remember, I was so nauseated by when all those coaches were talking about Belichick's genius for sensing Seattle's panic on the sideline and letting time run down instead of using a timeout. I am sorry.
That didn't happen.
I was at that game. I covered that game. That didn't happen.
He was staring at the clock.
He was staring at the clock.
Watching it run, saying, what the F just happened, and
he
how
froze.
Do we deal
yes.
with it?
He
totally
was completely,
froze.
Like, indisputably one of the greatest coaches in the history of that sport. In the biggest stage, in a legacy-making game, completely came unglued from the standpoint of, this is always the calmest, coolest, most composed guy. Him coming unglued isn't losing his mind. It's doing that. It's like freezing in the moment. He had, by Belichick standards, a meltdown. And a defensive back...
saved his ass.
Saved him because the defensive back was coached well.
Remember, it was a couple plays after that wild catch that was almost like...
I know what was happening.
Giants catch.
I know what was happening because... I think I know what was happening because it happened to every one of us in the press box. I was in the main press box. I was sitting next to some Philly writers. He makes that catch, and you heard four people in this row go, again. Mm-hmm. It's happening to them again. The guy next to me looked at me, and I don't know the guys. From Philadelphia paper looks at me and says, God hates them. That's what he said. He goes, God hates them, and he's punishing them for being the Patriots. And in that moment, that's the thing that makes the most sense because you're seeing this guy make another catch and you're just going, how many times are they going to lose a Super? Like, this is a team that could be going to win its, what, sixth Super Bowl or seventh Super Bowl or whatever. And it's like, they just keep getting beat. That's what was happening to Belichick. That documentary made it seem like it was like, oh, look, he was masterminding.
Cool
like it
Belichick,
was Obi-Wan Kenobi going, you will not make this. You will call
right.
the wrong play.
So the master plan worked out so great that with a wide open lane to the end zone, Marshawn Lynch happened to get tripped up by his shoe top by Jamie Collins or Dante Hightower.
If the Seattle Seahawks score the touchdown they should have scored, is the narrative coming out of that game not, you know, maybe it's more Brady than Belichick? Because Brady pretty much single-handedly brought them back into that game. And then Belichick kind of screws it up.
And he also threw two bad picks in the first half.
He did, but I'm saying, we would have been focusing as much on Belichick letting the clock run down and not giving his quarterback a chance to win that as we were the call by Pete Carroll, right?
Right.
The narrative in actuality is that God really hates them. Or loves them.
You know the narrative in actuality is? Both head coaches fouled up. One of them just fouled up more.
Rossi, good stuff, my friend. Right, you will be here Friday or traveling to Cincy?
I think I'm going to try to come in Friday, and then we're traveling that night if Caboli can make it. Driving has been an issue. We'll talk about that after the season.
Hey, our car got locked in the garage in Cleveland.
Yeah. Let's just
in the parking garage. Locked at 9 o'clock at night. Couldn't get it out.
Let's just say that with Adamski and Caboli, there's a lot of stops.
Well, especially after Chile, you know. Be careful this week. Doesn't sit well. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, guys.
Rob Rossi here on the Triple Live Radio Morning Show. Team Spanos Group of Raymond James, the face of financial guidance per Pittsburgh Magazine, brings Triple Live Radio to you. And our playoff coverage brought to you by Goodrich & Geist, pursuing justice for real people, online at goodrichandgeist.com. Thanks to Rossi for his visit. We got a boatload of Jagoff of the Year votes. Rossi went with Rutherford there in a very subtle way, didn't he? That was kind of gutless. He threw in like a Jim Rutherford vote, like didn't even mention his name. Couldn't even drop the name in. Yeah, he basically did. So maybe Rossi will get votes just for that. Let's take a few more, though, here before we take a pause. Oh, by the way, a signing in baseball. Alex Gordon back to the Royals, 4 years, $72 million.
Four years, $72 million for... Well, no, come on, Ken. Let's not act like this is the biggest signing in baseball. We all know what the biggest signing in baseball in the last 24 hours has been.
Oh, we didn't even get to this yet.
Your guys.
Can we save this? Can we save this?
We'll save. Oh, we will save. We want to do this as a tease.
That's what, $18 million a year?
Oh, am I so excited about this?
The biggest signing in baseball in the last 24 hours involved the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Okay, let's save all that and more emails to come. This is the Trib Live Radio Morning Show.
Game faces every day at Goodrich & Geist, pursuing justice for real people. Online at GoodrichandGeist.com. Injured? Do you have a case? Call Goodrich & Geist at 412-766-1455. Goodrich & Geist, located at 3634 California Avenue in Pittsburgh's North Side. Goodrich & Geist, attorneys at law, online at GoodrichandGeist.com. All playoff coverage brought to you by Goodrich & Geist, investing in the community with roots in Pittsburgh.
You don't need to face criminal charges alone. Call me, Frank Walker, 412-532-6805.